You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 19th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not in the literal nor metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building, in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, but in fact, live from the Families USA conference in Washington, D.C. We'll be talking about some healthcare issues over the course of the next day or two. But today on the program, we're going to be talking to Rick Perlstein, historian, also columnist for Rolling Stone magazine. He had a great piece up about Mitt Romney and... You know, folks, apparently this clown car race is still going on. Rick Perry has exited the clown car officially. Has he exited? I'm down here with Scott Milliken, the producer of Ring of Fire. I am sitting next to Tom Hartman. Of course, he's about to get ready to do his own show. Mark Riley has just walked in, shaking my hand now, so it's always fun to come down and see some radio folk. And Rick Perry has exited the race now, thrown his support behind Newt Gingrich, and I'm sorry, folks, you can't. As much as I want to avoid talking about this now, because in some respects I just find it's silly. There are two reasons why I can't. One is what's happening now. Although I think it is more or less going to be Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is the will be the presidential nominee. I more or less think it's over. However, what's happening during this primary is debilitating Mitt Romney. I think there's a lot of reason to believe that he would be a weak candidate in and of himself. But this is not toughening him up. I think it's making him tack further to the right. Now, the unfortunate part about that is that it allows room for President Obama to tack to the right. And we'll be talking about that today. At least a trial balloon warning, liberals, you're not going to like the budget. We'll see what that means. But we'll be talking to Rick Perlstein. He wrote a great piece about Mitt Romney and relative to his dad. And longtime listeners of this program know that I love anything that has to do with people reacting to their fathers in some way. And if you're familiar with any of my work from back in the days of entertainment, I don't know if there was anything greater than father issues being a driving force. So be that as it may, we'll be talking to Rick Perlstein. Always a pleasure to talk to. Also on the program today, we're going to be talking to Jeff Smith, who is leaving D.C. today, has been involved in the Occupy D.C. stuff. He wrote a great piece for the Daily Beast yesterday about Occupy D.C. and about his sense of the movement in this town and in general. But we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Rick Perlstein. We'll take your phone calls today. And a recap of the SOPA actions yesterday. Also, a recap of the Keystone XL pipeline decision. All that and more. So stick around. I mean, honestly, where are you really going to go? Nowhere, right? Back, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sam Cedar, and on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Rick Perlstein, historian, author of Nixonland. If you've never read Nixonland, folks, you don't really know anything about political history in this country. And
are you in a crowded place, Sam?
I am indeed, Rick. I am at the Families USA Healthcare Conference in Washington, D.C.
How exciting.
It's very exciting, but I'm even more excited to talk to you because I am a huge fan of your writing, and I'm also a huge fan of father issues. And your piece in Rolling Stone about Mitt Romney and his father was sort of hit.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, it sort of hit both quadrants of everything that I love. So, you know, I don't think people know that much about Mitt Romney's father. People our age in general, I just don't think that people realize how much of an important figure he was on the American political scene.
Yeah, and doesn't that say something about our political press that's such an important influence on one of the soon-to-be most, you know, important people in the Republican Party is just a completely unknown figure. It's remarkable. So, well, George Romney was basically the guy who introduced into American life the idea of fuel efficiency, and for that he became pretty much an international celebrity. He was on the in 1960. He was a CEO of a car company called American Motors, which basically introduced the first compact car, the Rambler. They called it the Kenosha Cadillac. And by 1963, he was governor of Michigan after presiding over a constitutional convention that rewrote the Michigan governor. So I call Michigan Constitution. So I kind of call him the James Madison of Michigan. And he was such a beloved and respected figure that John F. Kennedy in 1963 said that he was terrified of George Romney running for president because he was afraid he'd lose to him. And, of course, eventually he did run for president. He ran for the 1968 Republican nomination. And that, in my hypothesis, was the movement that really shaped Mitt Romney's approach to politics and turned him into the bizarre, pre-programmed robot we know and despise today.
Yeah, it's fascinating because his father was also Well, tell me how that worked. I mean, he's just acting in reaction to Romney. Is that, I mean, that's to his father, or is he just learned lessons, or
Well, let's lay it out. His dad's calling card, the reason he was so beloved and respected, was really this shocking authenticity he had. When he arrived at a conclusion, and by the way, he would pray and meditate for 24 hours before making big decisions, he stuck to it no matter what. And an excellent example is in 1964, you know, of course, he was a big Mormon, and he received a letter from one of the elders of the Mormon church telling him that Mormon teaching, Joseph Smith, proved that God had put a curse upon the Negro race, and that by supporting the Civil Rights Bill, he was going against God's will, and he may be stricken down for it. So there's this astonishing letter. You can go to my article on George Mitt Romney at RollingStone.com and download this letter. And, you know, how did George Romney respond to this? This idea that he was going to be stricken down for supporting civil rights. He doubled down. You know, he supported civil rights all the more. He led a parade down the middle of downtown Detroit in solidarity with Martin Luther King and the martyrs in Selma for the Voting Rights Act. So that's the kind of guy he was. And when he ran for president, when he started running late in 1966, Lou Harris, the pollster, said he had the best chance of becoming a Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower, that's the way he ran. I mean, he really told the truth without fear or favor. And it really caught up with him late in 1967 when he did a TV interview in which he was asked why he used to support the Vietnam War after he went to Vietnam in 1965, and why he was criticizing it now, late in 1967. And he said something that was basically spelled a death knell for his political ambitions. He said that when he went in 1965, he had been brainwashed like you wouldn't believe by the generals and the diplomats. Now, of course, what he meant was what actually happened, that they did the same thing they did to everyone when it came to Vietnam. They lied. You know, they distorted. They said the war was going great. They said that it was the crucial bulwark against freedom and that, you know, like the rats were going to be in our kitchen unless we held the line there. And when he went back in 1967, he saw that it was basically BS. And on that TV show in which he said he was brainwashed, he went on to give this amazing critique of the Vietnam War. And no one heard it. All they heard was brainwashed. And they took it literally, like he was saying that he was, you know, put in a trance and, you know, like subject to Svengali-like mind control. And the reaction was furious. He dropped 16 points in the polls. People were telling him to drop out. He didn't drop out. Instead, he went around New Hampshire saying that Lyndon Johnson was lying, saying that if you want to win the hearts and minds of a population, you don't bomb them and napalm them. He literally said that. And when voting day came in New Hampshire in 1968, he got his butt kicked by Richard Nixon,
right,
who went around New Hampshire basically lying about Vietnam. And that was it. That was the end of his political career. And at that point in his life, Mitt Romney was 19. And my hypothesis is that it had a profound effect in that Mitt learned that in politics, authenticity kills. That if you tell the truth without fear or favor, if you don't trim your sails to the ideological winds, you're going to get your knees cut off.
But, I mean, isn't that, I mean, I think that, I mean, that sounds very reasonable to me, but I imagine that, how did Mitt sort of take it? I guess this happens all the time, but how did Mitt take that idea of, like, the tactical lessons from his father rather than the lessons of why one might go into politics in the first place?
Well, why does one go into politics in the first place? I think it's a complicated question, but I'm sure that he admired his father. I'm sure he felt there was no greater aspiration. I mean, Nelson Rockefeller, who, you know, of course, grew up one of the most powerful and richest men in America, asked why he wanted to run for president, said, well, when you think about what I was given when I grew up, that was the only really thing that I had to aspire to that I didn't have already. And, you know, as a matter of fact, Mitt Romney has shown, you know, basically that he's taken, at certain points in his life, he took his father as a role model. I mean, in 2008, when he began his campaign, he gave his speech in front of a hybrid and said that he was following in his father's footsteps and working to end our dependence on the gasoline engine. So, you know, he's kind of tacked back and forth between affection for his father and rejection of him.
Well, Rick, to be fair, I hope you're not implying that he's flip-flopping, because that was almost 4 whole years ago.
4 whole years ago, yeah. And, of course, the party he's running in is even more wing-nutty than it was 4 years ago. And now he's a global warming denier. So there you go.
And you know, it's interesting because, you know, like one of the theories I always heard about why Al Gore was a wooden speaker on television was because he watched his father growing up giving speeches as a senator at a time where there was no amplification for his speeches. And so that the way his father would deliver speeches was in these very broad gestures that had to reach across the, you know, the room. And Al Gore sort of adopted that style, which does not work on television. It looks...
I never heard that before.
And so it's fascinating. It's also sort of disturbing, just this sort of amazing trend that we have in this country of politicians sort
political
of
political dynasties.
Yes, is another issue that is rather disturbing. Now, you also had a piece, and we should get this in because I think Rick Santorum is not long for this race. After South Carolina, I suspect, despite the fact that the evangelicals seem to have rallied around him. They don't seem to have that direct line with God that they used to, because he doesn't seem to be rising in the polls. But you had a great piece on Rick Santorum's quasi-acceptance speech after Iowa that I loved, because he was talking about how his grandfather, I think it was, or maybe it was his father, his grandfather came
grandfather.
Over. Yeah. Tell us that story, because I loved how... You really just sort of, you were the only person I saw who, in response to that speech, actually dug into what Santorum was actually saying that he didn't realize he was saying.
Yeah, that was kind of hailed as the best speech in on election night in Iowa. What he said was he kind of gave the typical sort of rags to riches story about his grandfather coming to America, and his grandfather happened to come from Italy, in which Santorum claimed, bit dubiously as far as the chronology goes, that his father was escaping the unfreedom of Mussolini's Italy. And then he went into this soaring account of how his grandfather went to work in the mines of Pennsylvania. And to kind of give a sense of the, you know, sort of hard scrabble life he had, he pointed out that his grandpa was paid in what Santorum called coupons, but which, you know, is better known by historians as scrip, which meant that his grandfather was a miner in a company town, and that he wasn't paid in cash, but he was paid in currency that was only redeemable at the company store. Now, some of you folks might know the song made popular by Johnny Cash, 16 Tons, you know, which talks things about selling his soul to the company store. Basically, what that means is that his grandfather was kept in debt slavery. He couldn't move. Because he didn't have any cash. He probably was bound to his job by his debt to the company's store. And what Rick Santorum was describing as his grandfather leaving freedom and joining American freedom actually better resembled slavery. So Rick Santorum apparently can't even tell the difference between corporate slavery and freedom, which seems to be very telling about the ideology right now, the modern Republican Party. They can't even imagine that unfreedom can exist superintended by corporate money. And, of course, what had freed the debt slaves was the New Deal. It was federal policy, the very thing that Rick Santorum and all Republicans pretty much equate with slavery.
You know, it's interesting, and to be fair to Rick Santorum, he wasn't the only person who didn't seem to catch that. there was very little from our corporate media about this. About, you know, frankly, any media. I mean, except for your piece is the only piece that I saw that actually dug into the implications of what he was saying. And it's a fascinating question because at a time where the Republicans, and I think part of that is because of the sort of the growing libertarianism, which always seems to grow whenever they're out of power. The idea that we can't spend money when they're not in power in the presidency becomes seems to grow in popularity amongst the Republicans, and the idea of freedom and liberty and this debate that really has not happened, and I have a fantasy that it's going to happen in the general election, but I know it's just a fantasy. This debate of the difference between the idea of freedom from government, so-called government intervention in the markets and in our society in some way, or the idea that freedom can really genuinely only be achieved with government intervention. The idea that I am not free to pursue my dreams or to in terms of work or whatnot because I don't have health care and I've got to do certain things to get health care, or the freedom that would be allowed for, you know, if we had better education or child care, or the list goes on and on.
Well, Democrats have to talk about freedom, too. And, you know, Tom Frank talked about this really well when it came to the town hall health care, the health care town halls in August of 2009. The Tea Party had at least a story about freedom, and then the Democratic congresspeople and senators were just going to respond with this kind of technocratic mumbo-jumbo about the law, instead of arguing that if you have health care, that if you don't have to worry about losing your health care because you lose your job, that's freedom too, and that liberals have a vision of freedom that's in fact superior to the one conservatives have. And until Democrats and liberals learn to talk forthrightly about their vision of freedom, basically you're fighting something with nothing.
You know, I wonder, you know, we just have a couple of minutes here, but I wonder if you've read, I just had an interesting conversation the other day with Corey Robin. And
he's a great guy.
And I wonder if you've read his book.
I've learned it.
Yeah, and then you're a great person to ask about his thesis, because he has a thesis that is somewhat at odds with Thomas Frank's. I think it's been overstated how much at odds they are. Give me your sense just about his thesis that conservatism is about reacting to emancipation movements, essentially, social and political and economic ones, and that the conservatives, that idea that they keep overthrowing the establishment because they're upset the establishment is not doing a good job at stopping these emancipation movements.
Yeah, I think it's true at a very deep level, and that's kind of Corey's value as a scholar who really knows the tradition of political theory. On the surface, it often doesn't seem that way. It often seems to be the reverse. But, you know, the fact that's so fascinating about his work is he recognizes these continuities in the conservative impulse, kind of going back to early modernity. And that really rings true to me. I feel this kind of gestalt, this kind of conservativeness that, you know, really kind of crosses generations. And he also talks about the sense of loss that people feel in the face of basically any social change. And those two things combine very profoundly. And one of the sort of subtle points he makes in his book, and I'm really thrilled to see it discussed so broadly because it really is a serious and deep book, a very scholarly book, is that in America, one of the reasons we have so much resentment against emancipation movements is that we have such a stratified society. And he points out that in American workplaces, we have more levels of stratification than anywhere else. I mean, everyone is someone else's manager. So everyone is kind of susceptible to feeling that, like, the people below them are getting restive or insolent. So, you know, one of the reasons we see this kind of Tom Frank phenomenon of people who are lower on the social order embracing conservatism is because everyone has this experience of someone below them acting up, or at least in their perception acting up. And it's a function of just how unequal the society is. It's a paradox. So the more inequality we have, the more people we have who are, in fact, feel themselves like bosses, even though they're much more bossed than bossing. So that's one of the reasons we have just so much kind of screwed up, quote-unquote, conservative populism. There's just so much free-floating resentment because so many people are used to the experience of feeling like they have power over someone, but that power actually being kind of an illusion. It's complicated stuff, and I really recommend people read Corey's book carefully, because that book has caused a sort of hysterical reaction among the establishment that really wants to see conservatism as something honorable that was traduced by modern conservatism, whether in the form of Newt Gingrich or the Tea Party or whatever. But the most powerful thing Corey's book has to teach us is that change induces anxiety, and that anxiety induces political hysteria. And once you get that in mind, a lot of the sheer unreason of American politics and American conservatism comes into view much more clearly. If that makes any sense at all.
No, it does make sense. I would also say that change, the byproduct of that change is not simply anxiety. I mean, the pie, whatever the pie is at any given point, is finite. And when black people get the right to vote, it necessarily diminishes the value of a white person's vote, because it becomes diluted.
And everything becomes a sense of a zero sum, and especially in a condition like ours of austerity and economic contraction, people are much more susceptible to believe that any advantage for anyone is something that's taken one for one out of their own hide. So change is especially fear.
Right, and do you think to a certain extent that the reason why things seem to have gotten so virulent now is a function of sort of that white knuckled grip on the advantage that essentially the white male had in our, I don't want to reduce this too much, but in our society, that's what we're seeing?
Well, Barbara Ehrenreich wrote a book that came out, I think, in the early 90s called Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the American Middle Class. And she argued that that was kind of the dominant experience of being sort of middle class in America, was that sense of precariousness, you know, because we don't have a social democracy, you know, we don't have economic guarantees, we don't have much of a safety net, that anyone who achieves anything economically doesn't get to kind of enjoy the fruits of that as in the form of security, but almost gets kind of like a surplus dose of insecurity, because they're always afraid of falling one step down the ladder. And that's why we see so many of the Tea Party people are, basically small businessmen, people with a little more money than average. And those are the people who feel most vulnerable to dispossession in a society like ours.
You know, it's interesting. I was digging around. It's a long story, but I was digging around for clips of David Halberstam. And in the early 90s, there was a wonderful video clip of him saying, I don't think that people have come to realize yet that the middle class is yet to have their massive panic. Although he was at the time saying that the Morton Downey Jr. was a product of this. The middle class,
Morton Downey Jr.
The middle class in this country is going to be competing with not just their neighbors now, but is going to be competing with the middle class in India and in China. And I thought that was a very prescient observation on his part.
Yeah, and that, you know, to take it full circle and maybe to put a punctuation mark on it, that's why it's so important to put at the center of the progressive agenda and the Democratic agenda policies that create economic fairness and economic security for the middle class. Because the more you get that, the more economic populism there is, the less purchase cultural populism has, reactionary populism has. So when, you know, Barack Obama or Bill Clinton pulls away from the Democrats' traditional commitment to economic security out of some sense that the public has turned to the right, paradoxically, they're actually weakening the ability of the Democratic Party to fight the dominance of the right politically. I mean, you really have to create that social safety net, because it's that sense of safety and that sense of security that keeps people from the kind of cultural panic, that sense of existential dispossession that turns people into conservatives, that turns people into Tea Partiers.
Well, I think that's a great place to end it. Rick Perlstein, thank you so much for joining us. I apologize for the telephonic frustration that we both enjoyed during this conversation, but we'll fix it all in post.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Sam.
All right, Rick Perlstein, folks, we're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street, just to close out this week of Occupy DC. We'll be back in just a moment. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Jeff Smith of Occupy Wall Street and
Also, as maybe you have read in the Daily Beast, welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
So, Jeff, tell me what you're heading back to New York, I understand, from a week of occupying D.C. And I read your piece in the Daily Beast. It was a great piece. And it was interesting. It sounds like you're not a huge fan of Washington. I don't know. You tell me. How would you characterize your response to D.C.?
Well, you know, I mean, it wasn't really about the Occupy D.C. people themselves, per se. I think it was really more the city and the way that I saw them react to the people in D.C. And I think it harkens back to what David Graeber was talking about, I think, when you interviewed him, and the whole Wizard of Oz metaphor, and that the Washington, D.C. really is the Emerald City. And so the idea that somehow we're, banging on the doors of these giant buildings and pretending as if these people are important to what's going on, I think was really apparent, especially after having spent, months camped at the door of the, behind the curtain of the actual wizard. And I think those are sort of the ways I think of New York and Washington as they relate to this story.
Yeah, I mean, in your piece, you said, and I don't have it in front of me, but you said something to the effect of that the Washington seems desensitized to, I mean, it's sad, but I mean, it seems desensitized to the existence of people who are saying there's a problem.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that it's as if the police and even the people that interact with them on a daily basis have gotten to the point, is it a strange almost Stockholm syndrome where, it's just been turned into such an efficient system of, okay, here's your little place where you're going to protest, and as soon as you're done making noise, then, we'll ignore you again. And it just really didn't feel like anyone that lives in Washington, or particularly the politicians, were inconvenienced in any way by this protest, or put off, or made to feel as if they had any pressure put on them. And so, I'm not sure if it's just because we didn't have quite the numbers that it was necessary to do that, but, I sort of felt like at the early on the stages when they, set up barricades and prevented us from moving on to the Capitol steps, I would have liked to see us just, run over those Capitol police. There weren't that many of them. Get up there, make our point, kind of be a little bit more forceful. But so I think that's sort of the difference I felt in terms of the tone and the way that people interact in D.C. And, I think that it really points to the fact that the money is where the power is. And, the politicians are almost professionals now at making protests, diminishing them in some way. I think it was Matt Taibbi that said that the professional left was sort of allergic to any populism, and it felt like they've got their regimen of antihistamines, and this stuff just doesn't bother them one bit.
There was a piece in the DCist. I don't know if you've seen it, but it was a direct response to your piece. I don't know if you've read that yet. Have you seen it?
No, I have not.
It says the author of this piece, and has an interesting perspective. The author of this piece says he somewhat misunderstands, talking about you, the ways of the nation's capital. It's not that anyone's nerves are dead here. Everyone with passion and a cause ends up down here at some point, but rather that people quickly understand that when you're trying to influence the legislative or policy-making process, you can't just set up a tent and try and goad cops into repeatedly arresting you. If that's all it took to create change, then every movement from the Tea Party to Lyndon LaRouche would be sending its minions to D.C. on a weekly basis to block traffic or storm congressional buildings. It's true that the initial Wall Street encampment drew its energy from a sense of populist disgust over how powerful banks are, et cetera, et cetera. But Washington is different. People who live and work here don't likely respond to New York-style occupation tactics. And they go on to say the same thing with the police. What do you say to that? I mean, I think, give me your response to that, because I'd like to respond to it, too.
Well, you know, first of all, I would say that, you know, I think a lot of what we did in New York and the New York style certainly played in Washington. And you saw, you know, not only the banks themselves backing off on various fees. You know, just recently you saw, and I wouldn't necessarily say that Occupy Wall Street is going to take credit for it, but I think a populist revolt that was very much not just in D.C. over the Keystone XL pipeline, and even to a certain degree this, SOPA internet bill. You saw how politics can be affected from outside the halls of Congress. And it wasn't, you know, aside from Google's lobbyists and the other internet heavyweights behind this, I think that it was very clear that a lot of people throughout America were really upset about both these issues. And so, you know, moving forward, the idea that the change happens, I mean, really, that's what they want. That's the way that they can take this fear of change and channel it into a way, into electoral politics, go visit your congressperson, lobby him, talk about the issues, and then, you know, the populism just becomes diffused. And so by staying outside of that channel, I think that it really allows pressure to be put on these guys, and they don't know how to diffuse it, frankly. And so instead of it being about this congressperson and what he has to do, it goes right to the source of that power and who's funding this position and, you know, shining a light on who's really in control of these decisions. And that's why we started to see these guys back off on cases. I mean, we've seen more, I think, progressive change policy-wise in the last 3 months, even out of the Obama administration, I think, than we saw for the, you know, first couple of years of his presidency.
Yeah, I think at the very least we've seen a change in rhetoric, which I think has been helpful. You know, I wonder if it isn't also there was a history in this country of protests in Washington having an impact, but I think that was also a very different time, a very different media climate, where the implications of coming to Washington were far more important than they are now. I think Washington is basically, and I thought you made a good point in your piece when you were talking about the idea of Occupy Washington being in many ways very localized. I mean, we all have this presumption because they're in Washington, it should be a, that occupation should have sort of more import in a national sense. But I think to a certain extent, you know, what we're finding is that you don't need to be in Washington. In fact, it helps you not to be in Washington in terms of having some type of national import. Obviously, being in New York, you're in a media center, perhaps the biggest media center maybe in the world. So that helps to nationalize the message that's happening in New York. But you also see the implications of things like what's happening in Atlanta with Occupy Your Homes, which is going very, very strong down there in the Atlanta area, and in Detroit, in Minneapolis. You see these occupations having resonance throughout the country and affecting the national discourse, albeit to a lesser extent. So it was an interesting observation. And, you know, I was talking to Tina Dupuy yesterday, who was covering this Occupy Congress this week, and she made a very good point that, you know, the yield on these things in terms of their having impact, if you're batting 500, you're doing great. And I think Occupy is doing even better than 500. But still, this is part of building a movement.
Definitely. And I think you're right. I mean, we do so many actions in New York, and the ones that you don't hear about are the ones that, you know, frankly, just don't come off that well, or that not that many people show up. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of expectations put on this one date in D.C. that was probably a little bit unfair. But I think also, you know, what Rick was talking about, and incidentally, by the way, I went to college with Rick Perlstein. We were in the same dorm at the University of Chicago. So,
oh, my gosh.
He's far more celebrated than I, but I feel I feel a kinship from that regard.
Well, first off, he's far more celebrated than you so far, I would say. And secondly, maybe this is the way that we should book every show. Just people from the same dorm in college, or maybe they went to two people who went to high school together, or camp, or it's an interesting thematic choice. It would involve probably a lot more work than I'm interested in at this point.
For sure. But, harking back to something that Rick said in terms of there's great fear that comes with change and a sort of hysteria, and it comes from that zero-sum game. I think the whole, one of the big messages of Occupy Wall Street is really that by focusing things on the commons and public spaces, change can actually not be a zero-sum game. It can actually positively affect everyone in a community in a way that is, not zero-sum. And so, when everyone has the means to contribute to a society, really everyone wins. Even the 1% have a better society when there's more equality. And so that's a pretty radical message, certainly in Washington. And so I think that, in some ways, we definitely need to get national, and that was the first really attempt to get people to come from all over the country. But I think, January is a pretty tough hill to sweat up as well. So in some ways, maybe it's a little ambitious, but I think that it was a good learning experience. And, there's big plans already for, I think, May 1 is going to be a huge sort of designated time for long-term planning. So
I was just going to ask you about that because I saw, I think it was yesterday or Wednesday, or maybe yesterday was Wednesday. I saw the online, I think it was at Muscle Magic, the first poster for a general strike for May 1st, and a statement from some group out of Brooklyn. And but let me ask you, because you've been involved in this since day one. Do you see? I mean, is this something for you? Are you too inside this to see, and maybe it's not even happening, but do you see a maturation and growth and the actual learning of lessons about the organizing and protesting and a greater competence amongst the leadership to the extent that there is any in Occupy movement? Both on like a strategic and a tactical level. Do you see that maturation? Is it there?
I won't lie and say that it's, a fully formed organization or anything like that. I think that what we've been able to do right now is collect, a really amazing group of talent in a lot of ways. And I think that's one of the great advantages that this movement had with young people that graduated college and couldn't find work that fulfilled them, and so many people want to do so many types of things that we've been able to cherry pick some really great people from all over the country. And that's also the thing about, what we saw in D.C. and some of the local occupations is that early on, really some of the most dedicated and creative activists all came to New York from the beginning. So the idea that Occupy Wall Street in New York is just a group of New York people was probably is a misnomer. But I think moving forward, we want to maintain that, horizontal aspect of it, because that's really where you see the creativity to allow people to just run with an idea, the sort of do-it-yourself mentality. When you start building hierarchies or structures, then it becomes, who's the gatekeeper for permission for this, or am I okay to do that? And I think that really hurts a lot of other progressive organizations. But I do think that in some ways you're going to see this thing sort of reform into something else completely. The metaphor I like to use is that, maybe Occupy Wall Street is MySpace, and, you're going to find people are creating Facebook, and that's going to be the next big thing come springtime. Overall, I wouldn't say that it's forming into any kind of a firm organization, but the really good people are definitely still working every day together. And more importantly, the issues that we're talking about, I think, are not getting less relevant to the American public. They're getting more relevant. You know, you saw the recent Pew poll about people, essentially class, you know, class warfare, whatever you want to call it, tensions between the rich and poor, are the number one issue in this country. And so I think we tap into that in a way that's really real. And I think continuing to do that is really the best way to get people involved in politics and counteract the sort of apathy that's been learned consciously for the last 30 years.
Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street Media Team, thanks for, and writer for the Daily Beast, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
All right, folks, and before we head into the better half of the program today, what I would like to do is, because we may not have Rick Santorum with us very much longer, as I mentioned at the top of the program today, Rick Perry dropping out of the, basically getting dropped off from the clown car, being left on the corner, told to make room for Newt Gingrich. The ever-widening Newt Gingrich. And also, you should know tonight, not only is there a Republican debate tonight, I mean, this is why I'm as much as I don't want to talk too much about the primary, what's happening is just too crazy. You've got Newt Gingrich is supposedly surging. He is getting an endorsement from Rick Perry now. And tonight, His second wife is going on to television for a two-hour interview. This is a woman who said, I'm not sure when exactly she said this. She said in the past that I could ruin his political career with one interview. And tonight she is giving a two-hour interview. I think immediately following the debate tonight. I think it's following the debate. I hope it's not simultaneous. But, and I generally am not terribly interested in these things. I don't even think I watched one of the Cain accusers interview. But this is just too rich. It's too rich, folks. It's a guilty pleasure for me. It's like eating too much dessert. What can I tell you? But before we go, like I say, Rick Santorum, not long for this campaign, even though he was declared today the official winner of Iowa. And, of course, none of it is binding anyways, so that's irrelevant. But Rick Santorum's not going to be with us too much longer. And we have the Screaming Majority last week sent us in a Rick Santorum piece. From David Benjoya. I want to play this because he said, imagine my Googling surprise to find that the word Santorum comes from the Latin meaning a frothy mixture of corrupt Beltway insider and fundamentalist bigot. Who knew? Cheers, Dave, Dan, Paula, and the Screamers. So here is Santorum's Lesser Googles by the Screaming Majority. I hope you enjoy. Here it is, theoretically.
Let's talk about Santorum while we still can, before he becomes another awful anti-Romney rant. What an asterisk, but a special case, because this ass is the face of the Republican base. When you're talking about Rick, the froth gets thick. But Google further down, it'll really make you sick. Everybody knows. Stuff, all the things that he says. What a prick, it'll really make you scared. So Google further down if you dare.
If you dare.
He's got problems with Muslims, a problem with gays. He's even got a beef with a JFK, 'cause he wouldn't take his cues from the Vatican.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. The screaming majority, ladies and gentlemen, absolutely fantastic. I am glad. I only wish Rick Santorum could stay in the race longer so we could hear more from the screaming majority on Rick Santorum. And point well taken. The Googling Rick Santorum and finding what shows up first is fun, but the really disturbing stuff is what shows up once you dig down into what he said. All right, ladies and gentlemen, now we will be heading into the better half of the program. You can call me at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. And please, folks, your membership is what keeps this show alive and can keep me, well, I'm not going to get into that. I'm very happy to be here. We'll have some a couple of interviews from here, if not tomorrow, over the course of next week. I am in Washington, D.C. today at the Families USA Conference. Many of these interviews you will hear that I'm doing here on Ring of Fire over the next week or two, including this week. And so if you can become a member, it would be much appreciated. And also, you know, you can support this program by buying your junk. If you buy junk through Amazon, buy it through our link at majority.fm. Just click support the show. You will find the link there. And you can also support this program and do yourself by getting some great, great coffee by going to justcoffee.coop with... use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off coffee, tea, chocolate, all of that good stuff, a great company, and see you in the better half of the program.
Ask her to walk with.